Welcome to Navigating Consciousness. I'm Rupert Sheldrake, and this is a podcast of my talks and conversations. If you enjoy listening, please subscribe and leave a review in your favorite podcatcher. It really helps.
We decided we would begin by asking each other some personal questions. And I know you've had an eventful year, Rupert, and I don't know that all of you are aware of this, but this spring, after a lecture he gave in Santa Fe, Rupert was assaulted by a psychotic young man who stabbed him and was aiming, I believe, for your heart, but missed and inflicted a very serious wound in his thigh, narrowly missing the femoral artery. So I don't know the whole details. I read a report that Jill wrote right afterwards. But I haven't had a chance to talk to you about it, and there are a few questions that I would be interested in asking you.
Yeah.
One is that in the years that we've been dialoguing here, one of the recurrent themes has been that things that we experience externally have some connection to things internally. So I wonder if you have any ruminations about, first of all, what was going on in your head that might have been correlated with that external event? What was it that drew him to you particularly? I'd just be interested in your speculations about that.
Well, it's like a koan, actually. I don't have any clear answer. He was Japanese. He'd come to the United States just to attend this conference on consciousness. He was hearing voices who told him to kill me.
Uh-huh.
He's in jail on a charge of attempted murder.
Had he read your work? Or
no, his English was very poor, and I don't think that he really knew much about me. He'd come to the conference because he hoped that someone would help him stop these voices, which were really troubling him. He looked really disturbed. He was going around talking to everyone about it. I was speaking in the last session of the last day, and I think if he was going to do something, he had to do it then. I don't think that he attacked me because I upset him by what I said in my lecture. Firstly, I doubt if he could understand it very well, and secondly, most people don't go to lectures armed with knives, so they can attack the speaker. So he attacked me after I just finished the talk. I was down below the podium answering questions, and suddenly I didn't see him coming. There's a huge blow on my left thigh, and there was a scuffle. He was rapidly immobilized. There was a large Australian rugby player standing next to me, and he had him on the ground within seconds. And then the police took him away. I don't know. It's hard for me to know just why this happened. I didn't have any premonition of it. For me, that was a depressing feature. But after I was discharged from the hospital in Santa Fe, I was staying with Larry Dossey and Barbie, his wife. He's an old friend. And he said, well, while you're here, Rupert, could you just look through the manuscript of my new book? And I said, I'd be happy to. So he handed it over. The power of premonition. So I said, well, Larry, did you have one? And he said, no, I didn't have one either. So we did have to discuss, you know, this failure of premonition to work in this case of a salient event. So I don't really have, it's still a mystery to me, you know, because it came completely out of the blue. I had no expectation of it happening, no premonition. I didn't have any internal turmoil that seemed to correspond to this. So
okay.
It's just a mystery.
Well, one other question. You seem to bounce back from this quite resiliently. And I wonder if you could just say something about your own healing, both from the physical trauma and the emotional shock of that.
Well, I had a big wound, 5-inch dagger wound in my thigh, and there was blood spurting out, and it severed several arteries. When I went to the hospital, the trauma surgeon took out a tennis ball-sized clot and sealed off the arteries. Funnily enough, it didn't hurt. And when I came round from this operation, it didn't hurt either. I had a morphine line going into it, and they said, just press that button when you feel the pain. I never took anything, not even a single painkiller. Somehow, it never hurt.
Right.
I don't know why, but it didn't. And immediately after I was attacked, the people at the conference formed a circle. They were praying for me. Some were chanting in a nearby church. When I was in Santa Fe, I had a constant stream of visitors who were tremendously helpful and kind. Supportive phone calls from my wife, Jill, and my family, from Rick and others. And I had healers coming in every 5 minutes. I felt so overhealed at one point. I had to sort of ask them to give me a break. You know, so a combination of healers. Oh, and then restorative foods. I kept having deliveries from the Whole Foods store. The first one, he came and said, Whole Foods. And he said, bag for you, sir. And I said, what's in that? He said, organic tulips. So I had organic tulips one day. Then the next day, he brought me a large organic pineapple, which he put on my side table. I was lying back with tubes in every orifice. And I reached up to the table. I had a small plastic spoon for yogurt. And there was this large organic pineapple. It wasn't a very practical present, but it did come in later, quite handy. Anyway, I recovered. I, for some reason, healed very quickly. And I gave a talk 3 days later. They let me out of the hospital to give a talk in Santa Fe. And I was so well looked after, I did have to say to people there, you know, I'm going to tell all my friends, if you have to get stabbed in Santa Fe. Because I was so well looked after. And since then, I've just been getting better much quicker than anyone expected. I'm very, very grateful for that. And I think the prayer and the healing certainly had a lot to do with it.
Good, thanks.
Well, now I guess my turn to ask you a personal question. My question, I'm sure, is something that's on other people's lips too. What does it feel like to be a brand?
Well, it's rather strange to be in rooms full of people who discuss you in the third person, who in your presence talk about Andrew Weil,
yes,
and this and that, and brand, how do we protect the brand, and is this good for the brand, and so forth. All I can tell you is it's quite strange. It's nothing that I ever asked for, and it appears to be something that I am supposed to do. I was under a lot of pressure over the years to products for one reason or another. One was that in books that I wrote and in talks that I give, I would tell people to say, take good quality fish oil or to do this, and people would say, well, can you direct us to products that are of good quality? I was very reluctant to get involved in that world, and ultimately I decided to do it because it was the only way that I could develop a stable revenue stream to support the academic work that I do. The Arizona Center for Integrative Medicine, it's now a center of excellence within the University of Arizona. I think our annual budget now is $4.5 million. And this is mostly, you know, we are the world leader in training other health professionals in this new system of integrative medicine. We get no money at all from the state of Arizona. We get money from the Department of Education, some from NIH. We have tuition that's from the doctors who study with us, but we have to raise an awful lot of money, and a lot of that has come from private philanthropy, which has been uncertain. So the only way that I could do this was to donate all of my after-tax profits from product sales to a foundation that I've set up, the Weil Foundation, which is now the principal funder of the center and of other integrative medicine institutions around the country. If I had been able to find other ways of funding the program, I would not have gotten involved and I would not have become brand. And,
I first became sent into a department store in Vancouver, and there was this life-size cardboard cutout of you. And now, of course, I see your face beaming out at me from my multivitamin pills, my granola bars, and so forth. I suppose the downside is it's a bit like being Dorian Gray in reverse, isn't it? Because there's the picture on
all beard on.
No, you can never shave your beard.
Really?
No.
And I have to.
And you can't grow old.
I can't grow old.
No. Well, one of the things I thought would be good to talk about is our botanical project.
Yeah.
Because first I have to explain this because Andy knows about this. We're doing something together on the island.
We're both botanists by training.
And inclination as well.
Yeah.
So this is a discovery that was arose on the island from Norm Gibbons, who many of you know, who runs a garden here. And together with some people here like Richard Pearl and my wife and Martha Abelson, we have some land on the island, and I was trying to find cuttings to plant in this forest land, and I wanted cuttings of yew trees. And I was talking to Norm about it, and I said, can you just run us off 200 cuttings of yews? And he said, well, no, it's not that simple. With conifers, he said, if you take cuttings from conifers, only the ones from the leading shoot grow into a regular tree. If you take cuttings from the side shoots, they grow sideways, and they form sort of spreading, sideways-growing plants. Now, I'd never heard that before, but Norm was absolutely right, and he discovered it. I spent a day in the Royal Horticultural Society Library in London looking up conifer cuttings and propagation, and I found that this is very well known. It's a fascinating thing, you see, that you can get a tree where the side branches, if you propagate from, grow into these spreading trees. That's not the case for things like willows or apples, and you can take cuttings or grafts from those and they grow straight up, but conifers are different. Anyway, when I went to see Norm, he said I could see the ones he discovered it with. They're cuttings of Thuyopsis, which is a tree a bit like the red cedar. And they're growing sideways in these plant pots. And I discussed it with Andy, because Norm didn't want them. He kindly gave them to me, but then they have to grow somewhere. And Andy in his garden's got a regular Thuyopsis tree about that high with a space around it. So now these trees are growing side by side with the real tree, and it's a very striking and interesting contrast. And I'm trying to set up a larger scale project here on Cortez and also in Britain of systematically taking cuttings from the top, near the top, and bottom branches, growing them side by side. And then one would have three trees derived from the same original tree, all with the same DNA, but with different structures. They're different growth habits. This leads into another topic, a bigger topic, which is a hot topic in science at the moment. It's something that I'm very interested in, namely epigenetics. Epigenetics means over and above genetics. And epigenetics is something that's become, people have got much more aware of lately. DNA is this kind of fixed genetic code, but it's sheathed in histones and other proteins. And you can have particular patterns of proteins binding to it that stop certain genes being expressed and allow others to be expressed. What's turned out is this pattern of silencing and turning on genes can survive cell divisions and in some cases even pass on to the offspring. So you can have completely different growth forms or patterns with the same DNA. And this was first discovered and made very clear in flax, the linseed oil plant, flax. A British scientist discovered that if you grew flax under high fertilizer conditions, took seeds from them, the plants they gave rise to were bigger and looked different from the ones grown on low fertility conditions. He then found you could actually produce several strains of flax almost overnight just by growing them under different conditions, and the seeds carried on for generations. So there's instant evolution, instant change, with no genetic mutations.
And there's a human bit of human evidence of this sort of thing. One famous example was a famine in Holland during the Second World War, and women during that famine gave birth to abnormally low-weight babies. Their children, the children of those children, were also abnormally low-weight, even though they ate normal diets and were well-nourished. Mm-hmm. So this has been taken as an analogous case. Mm-hmm. And this treads into a very forbidden territory of Lamarckian evolution and the evolution of inheritance of acquired characteristics, which has been relegated to the area of, you know, we set this to rest long ago, this is taboo science, we can't talk about this anymore.
But interestingly enough, it's really Darwinian, because Darwin strongly believed in the inheritance of acquired characters, Lamarckian inheritance. He did a lot of experiments, at least he looked at a lot of plants that had been bred and animals that had seemed to show an inheritance of acquired characters. So Darwin was a Lamarckian and was all in favor of it. Mm-hmm. The neo-Darwinians are the ones who say only genes can be inherited, the inheritance of acquired characters is taboo. It was very political during the Soviet era when the inheritance of acquired characters was orthodox in Russia and Mendelian geneticists were sent to Siberia. In the West, the inheritance of acquired characters was denounced as Soviet heresy, as pseudoscience, charlatanry. It now turns out that actually it happens, just like Darwin thought and just like some of the Soviet scientists thought. And I think it's going to shake up our ideas about evolution a lot, because you can have immediate changes caused by the environment which have effects over generations.
Now, even if we don't talk about this going over generations, if we just look at this in individuals, I think this is one of the most important topics in medicine, because a question that we're all faced with, and I'm asked all the time, is how much of our lives, our health, is genetically determined and how much is environmentally determined. And I think it's always a mix. It's probably impossible to draw a line and say this much is this much is that. But I would say, from the research that I follow, it is more and more impressive how environmental factors, including elements of our lifestyle that we have potential control over, determine whether genes express themselves or not. Mm-hmm. And this whole business of, you know, in any cell, most genes are inactive. They're switched off. And by the way, this is, you know, this, what you said about the conifers and the spreading. I mean, on a grand scale, this is what happens in embryonic development, that we start out with a small number of embryonic stem cells that can be anything. But in the course of their maturation and dividing, more and more genes are turned off and specific ones express themselves, so that certain cells are going to become a liver eventually, others are going to become a brain, an arm, and this is all determined by how genes are turned on or turned off. There's a very interesting area of nutrition research, nutrigenomics, looking at interactions between nutrients and genes. And it looks as if specific nutrients in foods that you consume can actually turn genes on or turn genes off. And these might be permanent changes, that if you're exposed to something, and possibly if a mother eats something during pregnancy, that this determines which genes will express themselves in the baby, which then might carry over to future generations. I think some of the most provocative area that I've looked at, I first saw this in some papers from Japan showing that laughter could actually turn genes on and off that determine the expression of type 2 diabetes. And that laughter induced by, this was done by watching funny movies, could actually turn off genes that cause type 2 diabetes to go into remission. And this, you know, it's very difficult to talk with Western scientists about this kind of stuff. But recently there was a paper published from Harvard Medical School by Herbert Benson's group, quite similar, showing that stress reduction training, relaxation training, could actually turn off genes that were responsible for producing proteins that were involved in stress responses. Mm. So I think this is a very interesting area to keep one's eye on. How amazing that emotional states can actually influence whether genes express themselves or not. So my sense is that, the genes we come into the world with, I mean, that's there. But there's an enormous latitude, including many things under our control that influence whether they turn on or off. I'll say one more thing and then stop. When I was doing research on aging and looking at what determines why some people age well and others don't, I think we can see all around us today a very interesting phenomenon. This is all in the news. You hear all the time that 60 is the new 50, 70 is the new 60. I mean, we see this. You know, people are aging differently from their parents and grandparents. Mm-hmm. Genes have not changed in that time. So this is, I think, a striking example of how, you know, many people today have more knowledge, they have better products, better services, they're taking better care of themselves, and the phenomena of aging are different, dramatically so. Mm. So I think there's enormous room to modify genetic expression.
Well, I'm excited by the epigenetic stuff because it's opened up a whole area. It's broken down the dogmatism that it's all genes and it's all rigidly determined. Right. And it now has given permission for studying the inheritance of acquired characters. Hopefully, with the trees, say the theriopsis, that are growing in the spreading way, if they continue to grow in a spreading way, hopefully we can get some seeds from and see whether those grow into regular ones or not. And of course, it would be fascinating if any of this does carry over in these conifers.
And if you're spreading Theopsis, cause my beautiful tall Theopsis to fall over and become spreading, I'd be very annoyed through their morphic resonance.
Exactly. Well, I'm excited by this because morphic fields, morphic resonance, for those who don't know about it, I have a theory of habit in nature. Each species has a kind of collective memory, not just of behavior, but of form. So plants have a kind of collective memory of the form of the species. And so new growth habits can be inherited by morphic resonance as well as genes. Both are involved. But it's one thing to activate and deactivate genes, but then what that does, the fact it gives an eye or a liver or a kidney or a spreading branch or whatever, depends on the organizing pattern of the tissue, which I think is the morphic field. So this field, this new epigenetic research interacts, interestingly, with morphic field research. And there have been several cases where it goes over into what looks like pure morphic resonance type phenomena. There's some experiments of Miroslav Hill in France. I don't know if we talked about these or not. They are fibroblast cell lines. And he developed ethionine resistance in one of them by exposing them to very high doses. Most of them were killed off. But he found that when he got one strain to be ethionine resistant, another parallel line, which had never been exposed to it, also became resistant, a kind of resonance effect. He also found he could induce heat tolerance in the regular line, and the control line became more heat tolerant. So there's already fascinating cell biology type experiments showing this. Well, I think one of the things I wanted to ask you was, and this intriguing thing is the future of healthcare. No doubt we'll have to wait for the whole book to know the whole truth about this, but perhaps you could give us a sneak preview of some of the themes.
Well, the book is about the future of healthcare in America, because America is farther over the cliff than any other country. But I think the crisis in American healthcare is going to manifest everywhere, where allopathic medicine has become dominant. The economic magnitude of the disaster that the U.S. is coming to around healthcare, I think, is greater than most people have any idea of. I mean, Americans spend more per capita on healthcare than any other people in the world by a long shot. If you see a bar graph of per capita expenditures, we're off the charts. And yet we have the poorest health outcome country. Anyway, you look at it, whether it's longevity, infant mortality, rates of chronic disease, you know, we're at the bottom. So we're spending more and more, and we have less and less to show for it. Healthcare expenses are now the second leading cause of personal bankruptcy in the U.S. The potential is that this could sink the entire U.S. economy if it's not contained in some way. And I don't hear any out-of-the-box thinking out there. You know, all I hear in the presidential debates and everywhere else is people talking about how we can give more people access to the system and who's going to pay for it. Mm. And that's not the problem. The system is rotten and it's collapsing. It doesn't work. And the bottom line is that healthcare costs too much, and that the rate of acceleration in the rise of healthcare costs, especially in the past 30 years, has gone up and up and up. And this is beginning to happen everywhere. It's certainly happening in Canada. It's happening in the UK. It's happening everywhere. And I think the reason everything is bad is because the costs are so high and they've spiraled out of control. So if you try to analyze why are healthcare costs so expensive, it seems to me that the two basic problems are, first, that we don't have a healthcare system. We have a disease management system. You know, we are spending most of our money trying to manage existing disease, much of which is preventable. And secondly, that the kinds of interventions we're dependent on are expensive because they're dependent on technology. And I would include pharmaceutical drugs as an example of technology. So it seems to me that's what has to change. We have to shift the system from away from disease management to prevention and health promotion, and we have to change medicine so that that it brings low-tech, less expensive methods in. Let me say something about the preventive aspect, because this will tie into something that you'd be interested in. What goes on in the name of preventive medicine in the U.S., and I think this is true elsewhere in the world, is pathetic. Hmm. The ideals of preventive medicine are very noble. But the profession of preventive medicine is very lackluster. It's a very low-paying field. It does not attract many people to it. And one of the reasons, I think, is that it has not been very effective. And I'm afraid that the reasons that prevention, we've spent a lot of money trying to prevent sexually transmitted diseases and substance abuse. We don't have much to show for it. It's another one of these areas where we've spent more and more, and the results are not that good. And I think the problem is it's the paradigm from which we operate. And it's basic thinking and conceptions that have to change. And the problem I see in medicine, and I think this will tie in with other areas of science that you're interested in, is that we are stuck in a mode of simplistic cause and effect explanations and linear thinking when human organisms are incredibly complex. Mm-hmm. The causation of disease is incredibly complex. And we need a new science of complexity to look at all this. And I'll just give you couple of examples of what I mean. One of the areas in which we focused a lot of preventive effort is to try and prevent heart attacks and cardiovascular disease. And the causes of heart attacks, the risk factors for heart attacks, are so many and so complex. There is a genetic influence, there's a dietary influence, stress plays a role, inflammation plays a role, serum lipid profiles play a role. There are all sorts of factors that determine heart attack risk. We have focused all of our energy on one thing, which is lowering cholesterol, but not even lowering cholesterol, it's lowering one fraction of cholesterol, LDL cholesterol, called bad cholesterol. And we have a very powerful way to do that with these statin drugs that are, pharmaceutical bestsellers. They've made billions for the companies that make them. And this is, I think, it's a perfect example of what I mean by linear thinking and not paying attention to complexity. Lowering LDL cholesterol is not the same as reducing heart attack risk. What you want to do is not only, first of all, if you're just looking at cholesterol, you want to not only lower LDL cholesterol, you want to raise HDL cholesterol, which statins don't do. You want to lower serum triglycerides, which statins don't do. You want to change the size and nature of cholesterol particles, which statins don't do. And that only deals with that one little factor. It does nothing about the inflammatory nature of cardiovascular disease, the blood clotting tendency. It pays no attention to the fact that 50% of people who have first heart attacks have normal cholesterol. Hmm. I mean, that should be a very sobering fact. And nonetheless, I have heard many, many cardiologists say that they think statins should be put in the water supply. What I observe is that the enthusiasm for statins relieves doctors of responsibility for dealing with anything else. You put a patient on a statin, then you don't have to even inquire about how they eat or how they handle anger or any of the other things that might play into or how they exercise. It relieves your responsibility for that. But then this is coming from the evidence-based movement that dominates medicine. And we have all this evidence that statins are so effective. But, here's another area that I find very troublesome. If you look at the way that the manufacturers advertise these drugs, the statistics sound great. A common study quoted is that statins lower heart attack risk by 36%. Mm. So in a randomized controlled trial, there was 36% fewer heart attacks in the statin group than in the control group in a certain period of time. That's very misleading. That's what's called relative risk reduction. Mm. You want to know absolute risk reduction, which is based on the number of events in one group compared to another. That's often quite small, like in the range of somewhere between 1% and 2%. And then what you really want to know is it worth it? How many people would you have to put on a statin to prevent one heart attack? Mm. This is a new way of analyzing cost-effectiveness of therapies. It's called the number needed to treat NNT. And it's the inverse of a study that shows that statins reduce heart attacks by 36%. The number needed to treat turns out to be about 100. That means you have to put 100 people on one of these drugs to prevent one heart attack in a 3.5 year period. Then you look at the cost of that, you know, in terms of the monetary cost plus the risk of exposing those people. Anyway, many of our ways of looking at prevention are based on that kind of simplistic linear thinking. Let me just give you one other quick example. There's been tremendous publicity about vitamin D, about the multifarious health benefits of vitamin D. It turns out to be one of our chief defenses against cancer. It's a hormone. We have vitamin D receptors on every cell of the body. And when I was in medical school, I was taught it was mostly necessary to absorb calcium and build bones. That's one of its functions, but its much more important functions are regulating cell growth and differentiation. If you live north of the latitude of Atlanta, Georgia, the sun is at too low an angle for half the year for you to make enough vitamin D. If we test people for vitamin D levels, which you should all get done and is being done more commonly now, very high percentage of people in North America are deficient. And that's just as true in Arizona, where I live, as it is up here, because dermatologists have made people so paranoid sun that everybody uses sunscreen, which blocks vitamin D synthesis. The best way to get vitamin D is to be out in the sun, because you can't get too much that way. And also, sun exposure induces the formation of vitamin D receptors, which you lose as you age. Taking supplements does not do that. Vitamin D prevents many, many forms of cancer, prostate cancer, colon cancer, lung cancer, pancreatic cancer, probably skin cancer as well. But thinking linearly, you know, the interactions between human beings and the sun are very complex. The sun, sun exposure has many benefits in terms of reducing risk of cancer, mental and emotional effects and so forth, probably many others. And it can be dangerous. It can increase risks of certain kinds of cancer. So, I mean, I think this is typical of an environmental interaction. It can be good or it can be bad, or it has both effects. How do you calculate that? But what we've been told, the message that's been put out there increasingly by the medical world, is that the sun is your enemy, and you have to protect yourself from it. I think, by the way, the beauty industry has fed into this, especially with women, of making them feel that, you know, the sun is going to age you prematurely and give you wrinkles. There's one study I saw recently showing that farmers who get regular sun exposure have lower rates of melanoma, which is the kind of skin cancer you're most concerned about, than people who get intense sun exposure not on a regular basis. Yes. So there's a lot more to be known here than we know. You know, and I think this is typical. It's not that, you know, it's just one more quick thing. You know, that if you look at our way we think about germs, you know, germs are bad. Therefore, all our strategy is of using germicides, antibiotics. There's some fascinating research on the benefits of certain kinds of infections. One of the most interesting and shocking to me when I first read it is that Helicobacter, H. pylori, this organism that lives in the mucosa of the stomach and has been shown to be the cause of peptic ulcer and probably of most cases of stomach cancer. This was a revolution in medical thinking to discover that ulcers were not due to stress, but to a bacterial infection that can be easily eradicated. It turns out there's a researcher at New York University Medical School who studied an expert in H. pylori who's found that children who are infected from an early age with a particularly virulent strain of H. pylori have much lower risks of getting asthma and allergies to pollen and mold, or developing gastroesophageal reflux in later life. I mean, amazing. So this is not, it's not just that it's a bad organism. It's that the organism is complex, the host is complex, the interactions are complex. You know, what you want to do is work toward achieving a balanced relationship with it, as you do with the sun. And I don't see how this can be done in the in this kind of linear, simplistic mode that dominates medical thinking at the moment.
No, nor do I. And I mean, that kind of research, like, I mean, there's a lot of evidence, I think, that asthma and these things are caused by too little exposure to germs and too little challenge of the immune system. I mean, short of waiting for the while bacterial pill that will contain friendly local bacteria, so collected from organic farmyards. maybe there should be other ways in which kids can be exposed to these without having to buy the pill. But that sort of research isn't going to pay drug companies. And what,
right.
Obviously, a new research thing's needed. Also, something's much more integrated, because when I was doing my research on pets and people's relationship with pets, as you know, there's studies that show heart attacks are lower in people who've been hospitalized for a heart attack if they keep dogs or cats. If it was just dogs, you'd think it was just because they got more exercise from the walk, but cats work too. So there's so many factors that affect it. And also, I think one really good change in science recently is the rise of positive psychology.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where psychologists, as you all know, used to look at pathology as their starting point. Now they're starting to look at what makes people happy. And the results are very interesting, and not all of them obvious in the first place. But we also know that if people are happier, have better social support, have pets, also if they pray, have religious faith, a supportive community, they live longer and have fewer heart attacks. There are many things like that, aren't there?
One of the most important findings is that happiness can be learned, that optimism can be learned.
That's important. I didn't know you can actually learn.
Yes. There's a book called Learned Optimism, which is by Martin Seligman at the University of Pennsylvania, who's one of the founders of the positive psychology movement. And it came from studying how people who are optimistic think and realizing that these are ways that can be taught to other people.
Yes. But I think that's
I would say, by the way, you're a stunning example of that in talking about your stabbing in Santa Fe. Mm-hmm. You know, that people, you could be thinking very differently about all that. And I could imagine you being quite depressed and injured as a result of that. And I think this is what I meant when I was asking you how you dealt with the emotional impact of that. I think that's a very practical example of taking something out there that you couldn't change that happened, but of interpreting it in a way that has served you.
Yes. Well, Peggy Taylor, who likes teasing me, has been accusing me of just spreading the burden, because several people have asked to see the scar, and I show it to them quite readily if they're curious and want to see it. I won't do it now in public to such a large group, but Peggy, you see, then she's very, very quick, and she saw me showing the scar to someone. She said, "Well, there you are, Rupert. You're just in denial about all this, and you can only you're getting over it by spreading the trauma by showing other people the scar." So that was Peggy's theory. Anyway, whatever it is, yes, I think optimism is really important. Obviously, it's important for health. And it's good if people can learn it. I mean, I think traditional religions, in a sense, teach this, because in all traditional religious services that I've ever come across, you start by giving thanks for what you're thankful for, like saying grace before meals. You start with gratitude. And gratitude, as I understand it from Seligman's work, is one of the things that tends to make you happy. It's very hard to be happy if you're feeling grudging, annoyed, angry, irritated. But if you're feeling grateful, and if you give thanks for what you've got, then that in itself makes you feel happier. So I think some of these are things that we've lost with people who've lost touch with religious traditions or religious practice. But, I mean, it's reassuring to know that they can be learned, and I dare say Dana will be putting on a learned optimism course next year, right here at Hollyhock.
Now, this is a good moment for us to take any questions, or let's frame it as questions, and you can direct them. Please.
Sure. Dr. Weil, I saw you on a panel with Dean Ornish talking about Gary Taub's book, Good Calories, Bad Calories. And I was just wondering if you could talk about the role of carbohydrates and how you feel Gary Taub's conclusions were in terms of the role of carbohydrates.
Yeah, this is a very interesting book that challenges a lot of the conventional thinking about weight and calories and the obesity epidemic. And Gary Taub is a science journalist, and he's a meticulous researcher. And I think that I agree with most of his arguments. I think he, as many people do, he goes too far in certain directions. But he says that the obsession with the medical community with fat as being the cause of obesity has no scientific basis at all, and that I certainly agree with that. He also says that the conventional wisdom that your weight is a product of calories in versus calories out is not accurate. That's you know, a more interesting conclusion. He also makes a very strong case that he says there's been almost a quasi-religious belief that obesity results from overeating and underactivity. And he says that the scientific literature strongly supports the idea that overeating and underactivity are both symptoms of an underlying metabolic disorder. I agree with that. And that if you think that overweight results from eating too much and not exercising enough, then this is a problem of will. And the response is to blame people for it or even send them to psychiatrists and psychologists for help. And the books, I think, makes a very strong case that the obesity epidemic that we are seeing today, particularly in North America, but beginning to happen all over the world, is in fact it's a metabolic disturbance rooted in dysfunction of insulin, which is the master hormone that regulates energy disposition in the body, and that a great many of us are genetically predisposed to develop this if we eat quantities of quick digesting carbohydrates, which are relatively new in the world, that modern food technology has transformed carbohydrate foods into ways that I digest very quickly and raise blood sugar. And in many people, this sets in motion this metabolic disturbance, which both signals the brain to curb physical activity, to curb the expenditure of calories, and as well induces eating of more calories. So I think he's absolutely right there. And, you know, it's a very provocative book. But to me, this is, I think he's right.
And what's the answer to change children's diets? And
I think the answer is, you know, I've just been writing a chapter about this and looking at prevention. Mm. You know, like knowing what we can do, what can we do about obesity? People are going to eat what's available and what's affordable. The foods that are available and affordable are the foods that provoke this response. And you know, we have to stop that. And any discussion about trying to get food corporations to restrict advertising or not markets or things has shouted down as interfering with business. We can't have that. I mean, we cannot allow this. It has to change, that the food corporations have to take responsibility for what's happening and to take responsibility for moving people's tastes in different directions. At the moment, our federal government in the U.S., same in Canada, through its program of crop subsidies, makes some of the worst offenders in this area, like high fructose corn syrup, so cheap that it's the ubiquitous sweetener now in everything. And this will probably turn out to be one of the greatest provokers of this kind of insulin response. So I think this is it's a huge problem that we have to look at. We have to change people's eating patterns. And that means changing the food that's out there, the relative costs of healthy food versus unhealthy food. Yes. We've made unhealthy food cheap and healthy food expensive.
Well, what about the opposite, like a carbon tax? What about a carbohydrate tax? Things that have readily available carbohydrate have huge tax on.
This is a possibility. But I would say also, to do it in a positive way, is that we should be making fruits and vegetables cheap by subsidizing them, because for many people, especially poor people, they're unaffordable.
Hmm. All right. My question is, what is the relationship between happiness and religion? And also, is religion necessary for happiness and gratitude?
Well, there's huge-scale statistical studies that show, if you look at people's life expectancy, those who have regular religious practice in a community setting tend to live years longer. I think it's 7 years or something like that. So that doesn't prove that it's just the religion. It may just be the social support, and these are big statistical studies. So that's one ingredient in this. You can certainly be optimistic without religion. I know optimistic atheists and agnostics, and partly it's a matter of personal disposition. I myself find it helps. I mean, I practice religion. I pray every day. I go to church on Sundays. I like doing this. I like singing hymns on Sunday mornings with other people and giving thanks. And so it works for me. It doesn't work for some people, but it does for me. And most of the people that I meet when I go to these services usually are pretty happy. And when I go to scientific gatherings and stuff, most of them don't look that happy, and many of them are not religious. So these are just personal impressions. But there's this kind of caricature view that people who are religious are terrified of hell and that kind of thing. It's all motivated by fear. Maybe so, but if so, not in the kinds of churches I go to. And when I went to the Cortes Island, one of the best-kept secrets on Cortes Island is the fact that there's a gathering on Sunday mornings here, a kind of church-type gathering in people's houses. And 3 or 4 weeks ago, I went to it, and here's this group of people who just meet. It's the best-kept secret on Cortes. You look in the phone book, there's nothing about church, worship, Christian. Totally, you can get tarot readings, you can get reflexology, you can get relaxing massage, but you can't get, hard to find. But again, the people I met there were delightful. So it just works for me. I think it's one ingredient, it's not essential for some people. But I think as a cultural phenomenon, it's very important. And in Britain, where the level of church going is very low, about 8% of the population go to church on Sundays, compared with about 55% in the United States. Very much lower levels of religious observance. This general atmosphere in Britain is one of sort of pessimism, cynicism, seen it all before. And I think one of the reasons that North Americans are so optimistic is because on the whole they are more religious. So these are just my impressions. Andy, you may have a different take.
The positive psychology movement drew from two main historical traditions. One was Buddhism, and Buddhism is both a philosophy and a religion, but I would say that the positive psychology drew more on the philosophical teachings of Buddhism. And the other was a purely philosophical movement, Stoicism, founded by a Greek slave named Epictetus, whose main teaching and discovery was that you can't change what happens to you. What you can change is how you react to what happens to you or how you interpret what happens to you. So I think those are examples of non-religious or philosophical basis for optimism and happiness. So I don't think that's necessary, but I would agree with Rupert that often travel together.
My name is Pete, and this is really directed at both of you. I heard about epigenetics from a lecture by Bruce Lipton, and he makes the intellectual leap that intention also has the capability of turning genes off and on. And I wanted to get your reaction to that idea and ask if there's any research that backs that up.
You know, until I saw this, these studies about laughter and gene expression, and now more recently of relaxation and gene expression, I really was not aware of any evidence of let's say non-physical influence on genetic expression. Without having seen that, possible. And given that, I see no reason why other aspects of consciousness could not affect gene expression, including intention. So I don't know of studies on that. I don't know of research on it. But I would say this whole, you know, the bare beginnings of this field of looking at non-physical influences on gene expression is fascinating and will grow.
And one of Bruce Lipton's points is a point we've discussed here before, the placebo effect, that what you believe affects what happens to your health and well-being. That's why people often get better with blank pills that contain. There's a matter of belief affecting your health, and it would affect gene expression because it affects the expression of the immune system. It may not have a long-term effect on gene expression, but this is a very clear case which is now completely recognized even within mainstream medicine. They used to regard placebo effects as a nuisance. Now placebo effects are seen as very, very interesting in their own right. Because they have such beneficial effects on people's ability to heal.
Maybe spontaneous remissions of cancer have to do with the turning off of genes. And there are certainly very well documented cases of these remissions being induced by prayer or visits to miracle shrines or other things in the intentional area. And it may very well that the mechanism of that is change in gene expression in tumors.
Mm. Thank you very much.
Big part of the problem that we abandoned responsibility for our own life. And it is only, not only in medical fields, but also in education, that we rely too much on other people's opinion and system, the system, instead of taking care of ourselves and our children. And do you agree?
I certainly agree. I think health is ultimately an individual responsibility. But I think also the government has a responsibility to educate its citizens as much as possible about health and influences on it, to work to see that our environment is supportive of health, and to create incentives and disincentives to help people make better choices rather than worse choices. And I think right now the state is not doing its job. Absolutely, certainly. Mm-hmm. Governments, people have the governments they deserve, so... No.
I think that it also comes down to a question of research funding and how that's organized. And one of the things I'm interested in, a practice I do every year during Lent, is fasting. I used to do it for a week, now I do it for 3 or 4 days. Fasting, i.e. not eating anything, just drinking water. It's a traditional practice in many religious and cultural contexts. And when I went to see the consultant biochemist at our local hospital, I was discussing statins with him, in fact. I asked him about research results on fasting. He didn't know of any. It's not the kind of field, you see, that gets research on it. If fasting works, as many people claim it does, including naturopaths, in helping to detoxify the body and make you feel better, there's nothing in it for the food industry or the drug industry, because it's free. And so here's a possible health procedure, which is absolutely free, that anyone could do. Where's the research going on? It doesn't get done, because government funding has to be in conjunction with industries and corporations. They have to have things that are supposed to be useful. This kind of stuff doesn't get done in the present system, hardly at all. And this comes to my proposal for science funding reform, which I've discussed here before with Andy. The idea that 1% of state science funding goes to fund research that actually interests taxpayers. And you'd ask people what they'd be interested in. And if there was in the medical area, I'd submit the idea of fasting research. It's not going to come up within the present system. But if the science funding system had an element of it, 1% of it, that was open to the people's suggestion, an element of democracy in a tiny fraction of science funding, some of these things might get done. I proposed this scheme, incidentally, since we last met, to the shadow Conservative Minister of Science in Britain, who the Conservatives will probably be the next government. He thought it was a really good idea. It was not necessarily that he thought it was that good an idea, but David Cameron, the head of the Conservative Party, had told him to come up with some new ideas within the next month, and he hadn't had any. And this was the only one that came his way. So anyway, I'm hopeful that this kind of it has to be political, because huge amounts of money. The National Institutes of Health budget is, what, $30 billion a year, something like that. Huge amounts of money are spent on scientific and medical research. And what gets done is what gets paid for. And what gets paid for is decided by small committees of experts and insiders and people from the pharmaceutical industry. And things like fasting research and laughter research and stuff are not
good. I'm glad you said that. I'd vote for laughter research. There's I met this past year the Indian physician, Dr. Kataria, who invented this system of laughter yoga, which is now all over the world. There are laughter clubs all over. You can look it up at laughteryoga.org. And he came up with a simple method of inducing laughter reliably in groups, which is not based on humor. And that's been the limitation of laughter research in the past. And his method was to have people assemble in groups anywhere from 3 to 5 to hundreds, and this is happening all over India. Large groups meet in parks, regularly, and there's a leader. They begin by doing some physical exercises and then some breathing exercises, and then they simulate laughter. And his discovery was that if groups of people simulate laughter, rapidly it becomes real laughter, to the point of tearing and falling on the ground and drooling and the other autonomic responses that are responsible for the effects. There's dramatic preliminary evidence of the ability of regular laughter to lower serum cortisol, to lower blood sugar, to rapidly produce an antidepressant effect. I mean, I can think of so many possibilities. Actually, there's an Indian physician in Tucson that I've been working with to try to set up a project at the VA hospital there with post-traumatic stress disorder patients. The percentage of returning Iraq veterans diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder is unbelievable. And as you can imagine, the treatment of this is very depressing and costly and difficult. Mm. And a perfect thing to try would be laughter yoga in these groups. I mean, this would be a wonderful thing to.
Yes.
Even a teeny percent of that of that budget going to that, I think, would be very fruitful.
Yes. I mean, I suppose part of the laughter thing is that laughter is socially facilitated, it's infectious, and it binds you to a group of people. It's right. Hard to laugh on your own.
Yeah.
And so that the other thing that's socially facilitated is yawning. I wonder if that has any benefits. That would be cheap and easy to arrange,
yeah.
too. Boring lectures as a health benefit.
This is a question for Andy, but Rupert, if you've got any input, feel free. And it's about preventative medicine. I'm a big fan of 8 weeks to optimum health. And totally on the same page as you. And I find when I'm sort of encountering people just sort of in day-to-day life who look really pasty and not looking after themselves, I feel like I want to bop them over the head with your book. So I wanted to sort of know about yourself, whether you have that same sort of evangelical thing and how you get your message across. And I just feel really upset when I come across people who feel really disempowered about the fact that they feel they can't do anything about their health, and it's all about doctors and drugs. And
I guess
what I feel most
passionate and evangelical about is that things are set up against people at the moment. Our society, it makes it harder for people to make the right choices, and it shouldn't be that way. You know, if you want people to be more physically active, then you have to make cities pedestrian friendly and have bike lanes. If you want people to eat better, then you have to make fruits and vegetables cheap and the junk foods more expensive. And we're doing it completely backwards. If you want doctors to practice more prevention and less intervention, then you have to pay them to do that. Right now, our priorities of reimbursement are backwards. We happily pay for interventions and treatments. We don't pay for people to give counseling about diet, exercise, how to learn optimism. So that's what I feel most aroused about. You know, that I think if you give people good information that they can connect with their own experience, I have great faith in people moving in the right direction if their path is not obstructed. And I think this is the problem we've got.
Oh, you've both spoken thematically throughout the evening about the impact of the environment on health. And I was just wondering what were the key sort of areas that you see as sort of strategically coming up in the next couple of years that we will need to pay a lot of attention to?
Thank you. Well, I'll just say, and this is something I'm actively involved in. I learned nothing about environment and health in my medical training, and this is still not part of the medical curriculum. So I'm trying to design a standardized curriculum in environmental health and medicine that can become a required part of medical training. And the three areas I'm most interested in, one is obviously the environmental causation of disease. You know, questions like how bad are plastic water bottles and cell phones. And, in most of these areas, there's great uncertainty and contradictory data, and how do we make sense of that, and what do we tell people? And a difficulty is that often the debate is shaped by vested interests, and it's hard to get accurate information. Second area is, I would say, you know, what actions do we take as individuals and as society to change the environment in a way that favors health? You know, and what is our impact on the environment? What is the nature of these interactions? And a third area that I'm particularly interested in is the particular environments of hospitals and medical centers, which are some of the, not only the worst polluters in our society, but also I think have created internal environments that are inimical to health and healing. I think if you try to design an environment that would most effectively sabotage the healing response, you couldn't come up with anything better than a hospital or medical center. And any way you look at it, aesthetics, being cut off from nature, odors, food served there, mental states of people in them. I mean, that could be changed. I mean, that's an urgent priority to think about. So those are the areas that I'm most interested that I would put under that general heading.
And of course, there's the social environments too, because we're social animals, and a lot of our behavior and happiness depends on our relationships with other people. And it's, whenever I'm in India, it's a remarkable thing. Everyone who's been to countries like India will know this. You can go to a village, people are incredibly poor, and yet you see smiles everywhere. And you come back to London and walk down the street, and everyone looks tired, stressed, worried. There's something about having supportive social groups, which many people do in India because of the strength of the family system, that is good for people. And I'd like to see experimental studies. For example, there's this wonderful youth program on this island and elsewhere, The Power of Hope. Teenagers come to it. They emerge from it glowing with optimism and all the kinds of things you might hope for in your children. Certainly, both our sons have benefited enormously from it. I'd like to see a kind of follow-up study of alumni of the Power of Hope versus control, balanced teenage groups and see what effect that has on health, social, mental, emotional, and physical. And so I think that the social environment is also one of the very important factors.